From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Closer economic ties between Beijing and Moscow were on the agenda Tuesday as a high-level delegation from China was in Moscow for a conference on relations between the two countries with Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and his delegation. The party said the main goal of the two-day conference was to assess the current status of Russia-China relations, with a special emphasis on economic coordination between the Eurasian Economic Union and the so-called Economic Belt of the Silk Road. This was China's former state counselor, Dai Bingguo, Tuesday.
We should cherish and value the comprehensive strategic partnership of the cooperation between our two countries. This did not come easily. It took time and effort, through the effort of generations. It's a great asset for our two countries and for the rest of the world. History tells us the relations between different countries are really dynamic and changeable. It's easy for us to destroy relations, but it's hard to repair them. Now we are going to strengthen our relations. We are not going to destroy it. We are going to move forward instead of moving back.
Ukraine is threatening to default on some $3 billion it owes to the Russian Federation. Kiev said it will refuse to repay the loan it received from Moscow in 2013, claiming it was taken under an illegal agreement. Press TV's Linda Savchuk reports from Kiev.
Ukraine has refused to pay its 3 billion euro bond to Russia. In its defense statement, Kiev has said the loan was illegal and taken under Russian pressure. It also exceeded the allowed debt ceiling at the time. Some analysts share this opinion. Russia, however, denies those accusations and demands the sovereign loan, which matured in December last year, to be repaid fully. Analysts say that Kiev is taking a risky position.
We know that the IMF's rules do not allow to lend to the countries which are in default on official debt and are not making good faith efforts to resolve this debt issue. And by the statement that we won't repay this loan, Ukraine clearly behaves not as a borrower with good faith efforts.
Kiev borrowed the money in December 2013 amidst pro-West protests which overran the country after former President Yanukovych refused to cling the trade deal with the EU. Ukraine restructured $15 billion private eurobond last year, but Moscow abstained from the deal, stating that its loan is official and is entitled to special treatment. Moscow sued Ukraine in London court to get the money back. Experts say Ukraine's refusal to repay its $3 billion debt to Russia may hurt its cooperation with the International Monetary Fund. At times, it is expecting a new tranche of financial aid this summer. Len Savchuk, Press TV, Kiev.
Meanwhile, more than 1,000 nuclear energy workers marched to the presidential administration building in Kiev Tuesday, protesting against the Ukrainian government's inaction in addressing an issue of seizure of the National Nuclear Energy Generating Company's assets. The company, Energoatom, operates four nuclear power plants that provide more than half of Ukraine's total energy demand. The company's assets were seized by a court order in March to collect about $5 million in debt from the company for Ukrelektrovod. According to a report at the Interfax press service, the seizure of Energoatom's accounts and assets, worth about $8 billion, by the court, disabled economic operations of the largest electricity generating company in the nation, halting all payments for nuclear fuel and removal of waste fuel, which could result in a stoppage of the reactors and a loss of half the country's electricity. The humanitarian situation in Syria remains critical, with nearly 600,000 Syrians living in areas under siege. That, according to the UN humanitarian coordinator Stephen O'Brien, who told the UN Security Council via video conference from Geneva Friday that the numbers were shocking in light of a cessation of hostilities that's been in place for several months. Deanne Penn reports.
Mr. O'Brien told council members that he has run out of words to explain how the conflict has devastated Syria and its people. He said innocent civilians are being subjected to even greater levels of suffering and misery. The continued use of siege and starvation as a weapon of war is reprehensible, he stated. He estimated that 592,700 people are currently living in besieged areas.
This includes 452,700 people besieged by the government of Syria in various locations in rural Damascus, as well as in the El Wayr area of Homs city, an area I visited myself just a few months ago, but has been closed off since March. Elsewhere, 110,000 people are besieged by ISIL in Deir ez-Zor city, 20,000 people by non-state armed groups and the Nusra Front in Foa and Kafr in Idlib, and 10,000 besieged by the government of Syria and non-state armed groups in Yarmouk, Damascus. These figures are shocking, as they underscore the sharply deteriorating situation for civilians, even while the cessation of hostilities is in place.
Mr. O'Brien said the UN and its partners continue to reach people in the war-torn nation despite the challenging environment. But he added that deliberate interference and restrictions, particularly by the Syrian government, continue to hamper aid delivery. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
But Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bashar Ja'afari, who is also the country's lead negotiator in talks with the Saudi-led coalition being sponsored by the U.S. and Russia, took issue with O'Brien's claims.
Shukran, Sayyid Rais.
Thank you, Mr. President. I was expecting that the Undersecretary General starts by presenting condolences to the government and the people of Syria for the hundreds of innocent victims amongst the civilians in Jabla and in Tartus who perished. The council denounced this and did present its condolences in the declaration made to the press a couple of days ago. I was surprised, as you were, to hear what he said about his visit to Turkey and what he saw there. Surprising things, as he said, in the Syrian refugee camps in Turkey. He saw children who didn't have food to eat. The question that I put to him and to you is this: what happened to billions presented in various conferences in Kuwait and elsewhere for the host countries, Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon? What happened about the propaganda in the Gulf countries and other countries who show the refugee camps to the host countries as though these were five-star hotels? Why is it that the USG did not become acquainted with it, that Abdulkal Amahaima Al-Sinia, a Saudi who recruits children and plays the role of a mufti within a terrorist organization called Arhal Hoshen in Aleppo? These are facts on which we need to dwell. As regards what he said on Jebla and Tartus, which were shelled when a terrorist committed a suicide attack. This is an incomplete description, to put it mildly. I'm saying this because he knows perfectly well that Daesh and Ahmad al-Sham did revendicate, did claim responsibility for these terrorist acts in Jablain and Tartus. So the identity of the perpetrators is very well known to him. Mr. President, some council members claim that they are concerned by the humanitarian situation, the protection of human rights in Syria. These states hold meetings and make statements, issue communiques right, left, and center, as though they were a dove of peace and only worried about the prosperity and stability and peace for the Syrian people. This is the way they present themselves, but the reality is very different, because everyone who wants to know can just take a look in the behavior of these states and see that they play an essential role behind the suffering of the Syrian people and the tragedy that has befallen them and the way it's being traded, which was recalled on the statement on the protection of civilians in Syria, Iraq, and Libya. There are those who protect the terrorist entities and protect them within the Security Council. This became obvious when some refused to include Ahmad al-Sham and Jaish al-Islam as terrorist organization under Security Council, despite the request made by the Russian Federation. These bodies work in an alliance with Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a terrorist organization, and commit every day terrorist acts. Jaish al-Islam targets civilians in their shelters in Damascus and Aleppo and other cities. They perpetrate terror suicide acts. Recently, they were carried out together with Daesh in Jebla in Tartus in Syria, as just mentioned. This, as I said, was resulted in hundreds of innocent lives lost. These same states refused yesterday the request from the Syrian government to put Jaish Mohammed to call them a terrorist organization. And this becomes glaring where these same states invite them to participate in Geneva negotiations as though there was such a thing as moderate terrorism, as though they were allowed terrorism and not allowed terrorism. The same states enable the access of representatives of these entities into their countries and allow them to have access to the media, as was done with the head of Jabhat al-Nusra, who was received by the Qatari channel Al Jazeera on several occasions, as was the case with the representative of foreign relations of Ahram al-Shena, who was in the U.S. On a British passport in January. And an article about that was in Washington Post on the 18th July and last year, and in the Telegraph. This is an attempt to burnish the image of this terrorism. All of this is an attempt to use them for political blackmail and to implement a certain agenda. This is what becomes obvious in the statements made by representatives of the estates, because they threaten very clearly that they will continue to support terrorism in Syria unless the leadership is not changed. This was said by the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Saudi Arabia and Turkey, as well as other countries. The same states impose unilateral illegal economic sanctions on the Syrian people, which increases their suffering and represent a huge burden on the public and private sector, who are trying to provide foodstuffs, pharmaceuticals, and the basic needs for the Syrian people. This incites some strata of the population to leave Syria. They are forced to do this because of insecurity and lack of subsistence. But the council ignores this dire humanitarian situation in Syria. Mr. President, how can we be talking about ending the suffering and the tragedy of the Syrian people inside and outside and put an end to the humanitarian crisis in Syria? How can we, now that the humanitarian and political situation is uncertain, what can we do to implement some of our goals? These sufferings are not a tool for political and other blackmail on the part of certain governments. This is something that was expressed in Erdogan's statement a couple of days ago, when he threatened to change this refugee situation if Turkish nationals were not given an exemption, a visa exemption for European countries. How can the humanitarian situation be improved when Erdogan uses the Turkish territory as a transit area for tens of thousands of foreign terrorist fighters, including the United Nations corridors? Furthermore, the Turkish regime provides weapons to terrorists and uses humanitarian assistance convoys as a cover. The representative of the Secretary General, it would seem, doesn't know about this, despite the fact that I myself did tell him about this on several occasions. We, furthermore, drew the attention of members of the Security Council in detail through tens of official letters that we sent. The Erdogan regime imprisons customs and judges and reporters who describe the situation truly. Why is it that the United Nations Secretariat rewards the Erdogan regime by holding the first World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, when the regime allows the recruitment of children in camps? How can we put an end to the crisis without handling the violations carried out by Israel, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia of the relevant resolutions of Security Council on combating terrorism, in particular the resolution 2253, which talks about training for terrorism. This has clear ramifications on the security and stability for the region. Mr. President, I would like to talk about the way that the issue of humanitarian access is manipulated. The Secretary General's report deals with this inaccurately. What he describes is very far from the reality. It's based on unknown sources, on unreliable ones. 2 days ago, we sent two letters, identical letters, to the President of the Security Council and the Secretary General on this. But I will simply limit myself to underscoring the following points. Claiming that the Syrian government prevents the arrival of humanitarian assistance to Daraya is totally false. In fact, the Syrian government
has allowed the UN and the Red Cross to enter on the 17th May to provide humanitarian assistance as agreed by the representative of the ICRC informed the foreign ministry that they couldn't enter into Daraa for logistical, administrative and security reasons, as he said. When it comes to the discussion that some are having as regards medicaments, the government of Syria does accept to forward medical assistance to all the regions except for the tools that can be used by terrorists. The government of Syria stands ready to cooperate with you to tackle any kind of issue as regards the convoys. As regards joint requests, there were 27 requests for humanitarian convoys into hot areas in May, under the May plan. The Syrian government did accept 19 out of those 26 requests. So 19 were accepted by the UN until 24th of May, 2 days ago, only sent three convoys, three out of 26 requested by the UN. The government of Syria did accept 19, and the UN only sent three joint assistance convoys. If there are delays when it comes to authorizations and their implementation, well, this is a function of safety and security of humanitarian workers. And our concern, the humanitarian assistance reaches those for whom it's destined. Mr. President, the government of Syria has always been committed to reduce the humanitarian suffering of our people. We are ready to implement any national measures needed in order to implement this objective. We'll continue cooperating with the UN to facilitate the task. But cooperation is not a one-way street. The UN also has to cooperate with the Syrian government to coordinate with us, to consult the Syrian government when it comes to humanitarian assistance, instead of criticizing us and expressing doubt without any result. The UN and other international organizations over the 5 years of crisis sent humanitarian assistance to millions of people only thanks to the cooperation on the part of the government of Syria. And lastly, Mr. President, we frequently talk about the danger of terrorism and the importance of fighting terrorism. This should not be interpreted in a way that we do not understand the depth of the humanitarian crisis in some regions of Syria, or that we do not understand the importance of improving the humanitarian situation in Syria. We do. However, we think that in order to put an end to the humanitarian crisis and put it in the lasting way, we need to deal with the issue seriously, to tackle terrorism, which is supported from the outside, and the interference in our internal affairs, and not through financial contributions pledged in various conferences, even though we understand their importance. The Syrian government underscores the importance of political aspect. We participated in Geneva negotiations seriously, so, and we are committed to that. The problem here is that some states impose the Riyadh delegation as the only interlocutor. And the delegation came with preconditions and with a goal to making sure that the negotiations failed. And they withdrew on several occasions following the instructions. Thank you.
When Ambassador Jaafari's comments were challenged by Mr. O'Brien and by the U.S. Permanent Representative Samantha Power, he again took the microphone.
Thank you very much, Mr. President, and I regret having to take the floor for a second time. I will not take up too much time. I was also presenting what are irrefutable facts, and if there are to be clarifications made with regard to the comments that I have been made, we are perfectly open to receiving those comments. We are one of the founding states members of the United Nations, and I am here representing that member state. We are proud of that status of being a founding state member of the United Nations, and we are proud of our involvement in the United Nations. But there is much at stake here, and I would like to respond to some of the comments made. The representative, the ambassador of the United States, said she commented on what I had said in the context of the report of the Secretary General, but those comments are not accurate. We are not, in fact, leveling any accusations. We are simply informing the members of the Council of the problems relating to humanitarian assistance. And we have said on many occasions that Turkey is using United Nations humanitarian corridors to channel weapons. Mr. O'Brien and his colleagues have not responded to that statement. Just a few days ago, it was shown that the Erdogan regime was channeling weapons through these corridors, and involving judges and journalists and customs officials as well. This information is, in fact, I think the comments that were made by the U.S. ambassador are not true. The United States and Iraq are. This is another case. I mean, I could talk about Africa, and we all know what's happening in Africa. We know that the United Nations organization, further, is a reflection of its charter. We do not want a new charter. We do not want an informal charter. We defend the dignity and sovereignty of states. And the attacks, that the threats to the dignity and sovereignty of states are something that we will not accept. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.